Golf Today on a Tuesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch Golf Week Magazine. We head down to Pebble Beach in moments. We've both been. I tell you, I think about Pebble Beach and I want to start singing an Enya song. Sail away, sail away, sail away. Who knows where the road goes? Only time. I love this week.
But you also have that sentimentality about Pebble Beach because you finished T2 in the Pure and Sure Championship there a couple of years ago, which the American people are well aware of at this stage. But it's going to be an interesting week because it's very much a venue that emphasized what the PGA Tour was of a certain point in time, which was that kind of celebrity-driven event, the old Crosby Clambake. And it was very much had its own character. That's all gone now in terms of what the new dispensation looks like. It's just 80 players and it's 80 celebrity / CEOs in the field as well who don't play on the weekend anymore. It's a tremendous change for this venue. It's a real change in the business model and revenue for charities from this model as well, because it's now one of the signature events. So it's going to be interesting to see if this is a positive harbinger for this tournament or if it's simply an anomaly that doesn't work long term and doesn't give the returns that the tournament and the community and the tour want out of it, and they decide to go back to a different model.
It's always been interesting to talk to golf fans and sports fans to ask them when they think the golf season begins. Is it Hawaii? For some, it's the Masters, or maybe it's the Players. You got to believe it. For some viewers, for many viewers, the golf season began historically at Pebble when you're maybe sitting on the East Coast and you see those beautiful greens and blues and the colors and the Stillwater Cove and the California Sea Lions. And yes, the celebrities like Jack Lemmon back in the day and Bill Murray, you know, cavorting with the fans as well.
And the dulcet tones of Jim Nantz welcoming us with views of Stillwater Cove. Well, it is one of America's most iconic venues for the PGA Tour this week. The AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. You can catch live first-round coverage Thursday, 3 p.m. right here on Golf Channel. And here are some of the notables in the field this week. A lot of the world's best players right here. It would be easier to name the guys who aren't in the field. Of course, Rory McIlroy, Victor Hovland, the reigning FedEx Cup champion, Nick Dunlap, the amateur who won the American Express just a couple of weeks ago in the field as well. And the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, rounding out quite a robust lineup.
Yeah, Eamon, it's the golf course, it's the players, it's the moments. You think back on the Pebble Beach moments historically, there are probably too many to count. We're going to do our best here. How about Jack Nicklaus, 1972 U.S. Open, height of power, yellow sweater, wind left to right and into on the par 3 17th, and he hit a one iron, maybe one of the best shots in the history of our sport.
And little known fact, Lee Trevino, playing right in front of him, hit driver and came up short.
How about that? And how about 10 years later, Tom Watson tried to chase down Jack Nicklaus.
He did so with one of the most iconic shots ever hit on that golf course.
Speaking of iconic, Tiger Woods, y'all. 2000, right rough, 7-iron, par 5, 6th. Roger Maltby telling us what? It's not a fair fight?
And it wasn't. A 12-stroke victory by the end of that week.
Tiger Woods bludgeoning the field, making the walk up the hill. 2011 Pebble Beach. This was DA Points partnering with Bill Murray.
This is a way to get Bill Murray's attention.
The celebration lacking, I would say. But it added up to a two-shot win for DA Points over Hunter Mahan back in the day.
Here's Gary Woodland, the last U.S. Open play there, 2019, on that famous hourglass green at 17. Gary giving the superintendents a heart attack, pulling out a little wedge.
You can make four from there when the pin is left, the ball is right in 2023. This is last year. Monday finish, Justin Rose, winning for the first time on the PGA Tour in 4 years. We spoke to him while we were in Phoenix, if I recall, interviewed the Englishman.
He did. Looking for a little recovery this week.
And then we have the 2023 U.S. Women's Open, the USC Trojan Allison Corpuz getting it done. 25 years of age, got to enjoy that historic walk of 18, being crowned the first U.S. Women's Open champ at Pebble Beach.
The father of Sahith Theegala there joining the celebrations.
Burley, what's Burley doing there? Buddies, the families are very, very close. Look at the Pebble Beach logo, 1919, that lone cypress. You see the history has hosted 14 USGA championships, including 6 U.S. Opens in that aforementioned U.S. Women's Open, scheduled to host 4 future U.S. Opens, 2027 doesn't seem like it's that far away, Eamon.
It's closing in pretty fast, Damon.
Yeah, absolutely. I serve as the venue for the Pebble Beach Pro-Am since 1947. How important is it that this event this week, and you talked about the fact that it's a new era, signature event, that it maintains some of that old Crosby spirit, even if it is a signature event in a limited field?
The one thing it has going for it is that the golf course has always been the star of the show. And I'm in the camp that was never a big fan of watching celebrity golf to begin with. I was a fan of watching Pebble Beach. I was a huge fan of the short course at Monterey Peninsula Country Club, great Mike Strantz renovation, which is no longer part of the rotation. In years past, players play three different courses and everyone finished on Pebble on Sunday. Now it's simply Thursday, Friday is split between Spyglass Hill and Pebble Beach. All of the weekend is on Pebble. So that's going to have an interesting dynamic in terms of what skill set comes out on top this week as well, because historically, iron play and putting tend to be the two key divisors of talent at Pebble Beach. And so that's going to have a greater emphasis when 75% of the rounds that they're playing this week are going to be on that golf course. But it's a shame to lose the Monterey Peninsula course. I thought it was really a beautiful layout.
Yeah.
I would actually argue it might be the best course on the peninsula other than Cypress Point.
I've played the short course. It is a fantastic spot. And you're right. Some people started to kind of push back and bristle against seeing the celebrities on that long Saturday. You've got the likes of Ray Romano and Kenny G, perhaps. And this kind of, it cleans it up a little bit, simplifies it. But that old spirit of the amateurs trying to make the cut, Jack Lemmon trying to make the cut, that was part and parcel of this great event, and some people will miss that, I imagine.
I definitely think they will. It had a character and a history to it that is, for all intents and purposes, now gone. We're not going to see those kind of storylines again because there is no cut for the amateurs to make anymore. But the flip side of that is we've had a very eclectic group of winners on the PGA Tour this year. A lot of long shots. You don't get much longer a shot than an amateur winning, as we did with Nick Dunlap. And that ends this week because there are no long shots in the field, really, in a signature event. There's 80 guys in the field. You got to figure if there's a handful of guys in there who might reasonably be termed long shots, that's about the most of it, really. This is really the elite. It's the strongest field we've seen so far this year. And that the folks at Pebble and the Monterey Peninsula Foundation that benefits from this tournament might look at that and say, you know what, this is a tournament that has lacked star power in terms of the golf side of the draw for quite a few years. It might actually be a reversal worth making.
Nine of the top 10 in the world in this field. Let's continue this conversation on Pebble Beach. It's time now for the Golf Today Roundtable. We're going to welcome in Rex Hoggard from Pebble Beach and Golf Channel senior writer Ryan Lavner from home, a.k.a. Georgia Bulldog Central. Great to see you both. Rex, I want to start with you. You're on property. We're talking about the vibe of this now signature event. Does it still feel like the old Crosby Clam Bake?
Well, I think tomorrow it will. I think there's a 100% chance of rain. And when they say 100% chance of rain at Pebble Beach, my guess is it's going to be 100% chance of rain. So we'll get Crosby weather. But I think Eamon is absolutely correct. When you look at the future of this event, this was a proven commodity. Whether if you like the celebrity version of the competition or not, there was a draw to it. There was the idea that you're sitting on the East Coast, you're freezing to death, and you're watching this beautiful golf course and the celebrities mixed in with some tour players. That was this event's identity. Now it's moving to something else. And I think Jordan Spieth said this a few weeks ago in an interview that he did. It's a very important year for the PGA Tour to prove kind of it's a proof of concept at this point. Are the signature events going to deliver what the tour hopes they deliver? This is the first week they can get a look at that and decide, did they make this tournament better? I think it's a huge week for the tour.
Ryan, there's always something to fight over on tour, and the players aren't shy about fighting over it. And one of the things that got some attention this week is the sponsor exemptions into the field. There are four of them. Three of them have gone to members of the PGA Tour's policy board. Do you think that's something the tour needs to be sensitive to? You can make a case for all of those guys getting the exemptions. That's not the issue. But the perception that the elite players are kind of feathering their nest even more so than the signature events are allowing them to do so. Is this going to be an issue with the rank and file, you think?
I certainly think it's something to be cognizant of as we continue on with the signature events for the rest of 2024. Sensitive was the word you used, and I would say that's perfectly appropriate in this, because the signature events give these guys such a head start when it comes to the FedEx Cup standings that every sponsor exemption deserves to be scrutinized and justified. And at least this week, it does seem like a thank you note to the players on the PGA Tour policy board for getting the PGA Tour to the point where now we're at least expecting the U.S. investor deal with Strategic Sports Group to be finalized and announced any moment. Maverick McNealy, to me, is a different situation, an AT&T ambassador. He played at Stanford. He has a great record at Pebble Beach. But if you start to see some more of these handouts, I certainly think that's something that's going to infuriate the rest of the PGA Tour membership.
And I think when you're going to hear the players continue to grumble about this, I don't think this will be the last we hear of a sponsor exemption going to someone on the policy board. And it does seem like patronage at that point. I think what we'll see as we get further and further into the season, the tour, at least the tournaments, will start being a little bit more judicious about how they hand those sponsor exemptions out. Because as we've talked about this on the show before, you don't want them going to just one category of player. The tour is very clear as far as who these are supposed to go to. Sort of the rank and file immediately comes to mind.
Rex, the players are getting ready for these small greens, the cold weather and the rain. There was also a PAC meeting, from what I understand, yesterday. What came out of that?
I think it was a lively meeting by all accounts. I think if you look at the makeup of the Player Advisory Council right now, they added some players who have been very outspoken about a lot of the changes, specifically the signature event model that the tour has moved to, what we were just talking about as far as how the sponsor exemptions get handed out. They added Lonto Griffin and Grayson Murray to the 16-player pack, and I think those are going to be two very loud voices in the room. They've been outspoken against a lot of things that the PGA Tour has done, and I think last night was an example of that.
Ryan, the LIV Golf Tour is also starting its season this week down in Mexico, and just a few moments ago, John Rahm's team was finalized. It's Tyrrell Hatton, Kieran Vincent, and Caleb Surratt, who just left college for LIV Golf. Is this going to make any material difference in terms of putting LIV in a position to have more audience traction this season than it did last year?
I'm not so sure, Damon. I mean, LIV Golf already had Phil Mickelson, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau. Those guys are already needle movers, and it got to a point where the LIV Golf stopped reporting its TV ratings because they were so abysmal. I think when you look at the additions of these players, plus Adrian Meronk, who's supposed to be signing with Martin Keimer's Cleek's team, I think the bigger point here is that these are two top 40 players who would be moving away from the PGA Tour onto a different product. They're highly competitive. They haven't shown their best in the major championships, but you could at least foresee a scenario where their best golf is still ahead of them. And it's getting to a point where we're getting further away from what golf fans want, which is what to have the best players in the world all competing against each other in the same place. To me, that's the big takeaway, whether it reduces the PGA Tour or maximizes LIV Golf in some marginal way. I think we're actually just getting further away from where we actually want to be.
Lav, what about the impact of Caleb Surratt? You're talking about one of the best collegians we have in the country, Arnold Palmer Cup member, Walker Cup member, an incredible junior golf career as well. What kind of impact might his decision have on the collegians behind him?
So it's very interesting, especially when you consider it came in the wake of Nick Dunlap's decision to pursue PGA Tour membership, when I'm sure LIV Golf also made a run at him. And I put Nick Dunlap in a completely different category, right? Like, he's the first amateur who went on tour in 33 years. He had such a runway ahead of him that it would almost be impossible to turn that down. But Caleb Surratt is such an interesting situation, because I personally thought after LIV's launch, the best avenue for success was going to be to target some of these young amateur studs. And they actually haven't been that successful in poaching those kids from college as you might think. You had David Pooge from Arizona State. He had Eugenio Shikar from Oklahoma State, who was a top five amateur at the time, but that's really it. And so I think, you know, a lot of people will talk about Tyrrell Hatton and the impact that that's going to have on the European Ryder Cup team. Caleb Surratt, to me, though, Damon, is the most interesting piece because of what he can represent. He was a top junior. He was a number one ranked amateur at this time last year. The PGA Tour is not that far removed from the situation where all of these top players in college and amateur golf had to go toil for a year or two on the Korn Ferry Tour to then make it to the PGA Tour. And so the PGA Tour is going to have to continue to tweak and to really analyze its process for how they get these young players onto the PGA Tour as fast as possible, because Caleb Surratt could show that there's a pathway, if you're an underclassman or a junior in college golf, to be able to make a lot of money and compete against world-class players right away.
Rex, I want to go back to this PAC meeting last night. You noticed that the tour over the weekend announced who the new members of the PAC were. There are 9 new guys on there. 8 of them would be considered rank and file. There are a couple of people like Lanto Griffin, Grayson Murray, who've been pretty vocal and hostile to the direction that the tour has been moving. And now we're moving into the period where the Strategic Sports Group private equity deal is imminent. Decisions are going to be made that are going to leave the rank and file feeling pretty raw at times out there. Are you expecting some kind of fireworks or movement in that panel over the course of this season as the arguments start to pick up a little bit of steam?
I think the addition of Lanto and specifically Grayson to the pack, that's sort of a nod to that rank and file that you mentioned. I think the tour understands that there was pushback. There was a letter that was sent to the commissioner just late last year from a group of players who really just wanted an audience. They wanted their voice to be heard. And I think where we are right now, there is so much uncertainty in where the tour is going. Lab just brought up SSG. However that deal plays out, the deal with the PIF from Saudi Arabia, that's going to be a whole different scenario. However, when it comes to the actual players in the room who are going to be making the decisions, and I've heard this for decades on the PGA Tour, the PAC can have a conversation and they're going to hear information before everyone else, but that doesn't necessarily mean they have a voice. Every member that I've spoken to who served on the PAC said that it was kind of a waste of time, because the tour is going to do what the policy board wants to do, not what the PAC wants to do. It's a very important distinction, especially right now, because the PGA Tour has made a clear decision. They're going to lean towards the star players. And even the addition of Lanto and Grayson to the pack, I don't think is going to change that.
And the policy board is heavily skewed towards those elite players right now, Rex. And I noticed in the press release the tour sent out, it lists all of the player directors on the policy board, and it lists the duration of their term as a director, all except Tiger Woods. We know when everyone else is leaving the board. Tiger was co-opted onto the board when the players started to get upset last year. He's now kind of like a dear leader in North Korea. He seems to have an indefinite term on the board. Does the tour need to offer some kind of clarity as to when Tiger's term of office will expire on the board?
I would think so, and that would probably come sooner rather than later. And my guess is that comes after we land wherever it is we're going to land with the negotiations. Whatever comes from the negotiations with SSG and PIF, I believe after that you'll start to see Tiger probably phase himself off the board, because as Rory articulated last year, it's very consuming. I can imagine it's only become more consuming over the last few months if these negotiations have heated up. I think most players will tell you they are comfortable with Tiger Woods having, I don't want to call it an indefinite stay on the policy board, but they want his voice to be one of the loudest in the room, and that's what you have right now. But I don't think that Tiger Woods wants to be on the board indefinitely.
Didn't expect a North Korea Tiger Woods reference on this Tuesday edition of Golf Today. Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lambert joining us for the Golf Today Roundtable.
We are back on Golf Today. This year marks 25 years since Payne Stewart won the 1999 U.S. Open at Pinehurst No. 2. See that incredible par save in the moment. Sank that 15-footer to finish one shot better than Phil Mickelson and avoid a Monday playoff. What a time it was. Tragically, Payne lost his life in a plane crash later that year in October. Today is his birthday. He would have been 67 years old today. And what a career it was. 465 events played on the PGA Tour from 1979 to 1999. 11 wins, including 3 majors, a runner-up 25 times, played for the United States in 5 Ryder Cups. So pleased to be joined now by Victoria Neno, a senior historian with the USGA Museum, for more on the life and legacy of Payne. It's great to see you, Victoria, in so many ways. It feels like it was yesterday, that 1999 U.S. Open. What more should we know about that dramatic finish?
Well, this was one of the classic finishes in all of U.S. Open history. 1999 was Payne Stewart's shining moment on the world stage of golf. It was, of course, Pinehurst's first U.S. Open, the first time the USGA held the championship there, and set the foundation for, of course, many decades of amazing championships at Pinehurst. But there was a charismatic hero, a difficult test, an epic battle, and a thrilling victory. Obviously, young Tiger Woods and Vijay Singh were both in contention there on the final day until it became a duel between Phil Mickelson and Payne Stewart. And it was hard to tell a gallery favorite because everyone was cheering so hard for both men. But this is one of those great moments where Payne Stewart shows us down the stretch, 16, 17, and 18, what a true U.S. Open champion is. He uses focus, resolve, creativity, and grit. And his final finish, his celebration, sinking that 15-foot putt to win the U.S. Open, is just an exclamation point on not only his career and this victory, but his life, truly. And jumping into his caddy's arms, it was just a moment that transcended not only sport, but it's universal. It's such a human moment. It's totally unforgettable.
We're going to see a similar chapter written this summer when the U.S. Open goes back to Pinehurst number two. Victoria, what are the plans to commemorate Payne Stewart when we get there in June to mark the 25th anniversary?
Well, I'm sure you'll see many different ways in which the 25th anniversary of Payne's historic victory is commemorated there at the U.S. Open. Certainly, that flag that they always have on the final hole on Sunday at Pinehurst for all people who play Pinehurst number two, that the same hole location where Payne sunk his famous 15-foot putt. I think there will be many ways in which Payne will be remembered. At the 2014 U.S. Open, of course, Stewart was honored with the Bob Jones Award, recognizing sportsmanship in golf. So I think you'll feel his spirit throughout the entire week.
Why do we remember Payne Stewart so vividly to this day?
Well, history really puts our lives in perspectives. It gives us a greater understanding of who we are, how we want to be remembered. And in 1999, Payne Stewart lived his life to the fullest, unapologetically passionate about his place in the world as not only a husband and father and friend, but as a professional golfer. So I think when we watch that final moment on the green, it transcends time and his emotions and what he achieves there. Few moments in golf carry that level of emotional weight.
Yes, so many of us looking forward to June. Victoria, thank you so much for your time today.
Awesome. Great to be here. Thank you.
Amazing to think Payne Stewart would have been 67 today. We remember the impish grin, the style, the lovely cadence to his swing. He was one of a kind. We're back on golf today. How about these pictures? AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am marks the second signature event of the season. You got Spyglass Hill, Pebble Beach, used for the first couple of rounds. The tour pros will be joined by a limited number of amateur partners. Pebble will be the sole venue on the weekend. This event moved to Pebble in 1947, been completed on the Monterey Peninsula ever since, exception of 1996, when heavy rain forced cancellation of the tournament. Rain is in the forecast this week. Hopefully it is not too torrential. The Golf Course Superintendents Association of America is the professional association for the men and women who manage and maintain the game's most valuable resource. What is that? That's the golf course. Industry recognizes the association as a key contributor in elevating the game and business. It's another big week in the game as this marks the annual GCSAA conference trade show in Phoenix, Arizona, the 94th conference, the largest international gathering of turf grass professionals. We're pleased to be joined now by Rhett Evans, the CEO of the Golf Course Superintendent Association of America. Rhett, it's great to see you. What's going on in Phoenix besides the great weather?
I'll tell you what, certainly the sun is shining, gentlemen. We're here on the streets of the Phoenix Convention Center, and we're rocking and rolling. In fact, behind me, we've got the Sustainability Showcase that's kicking off this show, and we're here learning all about the new innovations and things that are coming to a golf course near you. And we've got 11,000 individuals that are learning how to do it.
On that subject of sustainability, Rhett, it's obviously a huge issue in golf right now. Specifically, what's happening at the conference to address that issue?
Yeah, you know, and again, to use this backdrop behind me, you're looking at, again, five different types of grasses that have been developed that you know, use less water. They're more drought tolerant and less susceptible to diseases. Right there, you know, is helping with our sustainability equation. And, you know, this tea box that's directly behind me literally is a bathtub that captures water and just continues to recycle it. And so this whole area, from the solar panels to what we're doing with drip irrigation, the hydroponic technology, we're basically creating an opportunity for golf to continue to be sustainable. And when you look at the practices that are in place, we're decreasing water use right now by 29%. When we look at nutrients, those two are dropping. And so we're doing some terrific things and yet maintaining the quality of the turf grass and the playing surfaces that we know as golfers we expect. And so it's a great balance. And here at the Golf Industry Show, the GCSA Conference and Trade Show, all of this is coming to life, and we're going to have our 20,000 members out there doing just what you see here behind me.
Rhett, even with the challenges, you know, we're coming off a PGA Show, lots of optimism in Orlando. How would you describe the optimism level in Phoenix?
Yeah, you know, this certainly sets the tone and sets the bar for the year. And you know, that optimism is high. You know, golf's never been in a better spot. When you look at the 26.6 million people that are playing this game, it continues to increase ever since COVID. But that certainly comes with a whole new set of challenges, right? We've got more wear and tear on the turf. We have more players that are playing the game and more stress. And not only that, but environmental stresses. We've got changing water conditions. We've now got droughts in states that we just hadn't had before. Utah, certainly Nevada, Arizona, California, they've been dealing with this for some time. But those are continuing to increase. And the pressure that we have and that we're under as a game to get the golf course right is significant. And I think we all need to be aware of that, because without a golf course, there is no business or game of golf. And so it all starts with the golf course. And so it's a collective effort for golfers to understand what we need to be doing, and certainly owners and operators and all of us that love this game.
Is that part of the motivation, excuse me, this week, Rhett, to explain to golfers why it matters what's happening there? Because it's very easy to just dismiss it as a trade show, right? That's not really consumer facing, but they do need to understand what happens there directly impacts their own experience.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think that's so key, right? You know, we're all in this together. And I think when, you know, when golfers and the public understand the why, you know, why certain things are taking place, that they get it. And so having that voice and having that education and advocating on behalf of the environmental benefits that come from the 2 million acres of green space that we have in the United States, even if you don't play golf, to be able to have that golf course next to your property where we can create wildlife corridors, where we can filter that stormwater runoff that comes from the streets and the shopping malls. And all of a sudden they start to say, you know what, this is important that we have this green space. And now we just need to manage it accordingly and continue to make those improvements so that we can sustain it going forward. And so, yes, that is a motivation of this conference. And we're going to be educating our members on those very topics.
Rhett, we play this game, we love this game, we arrive to golf courses, we tee it up, have a nice bite to eat and go home. The superintendents are there at all hours, early, they're late. Are they underappreciated in your mind in the big picture of this game?
Well, I they are, and they are the unsung heroes of the game. And while, you know, I think it's a collective effort and everybody, you know, that has a role in the game is important. But I go back to what I said earlier, you know, without the golf course, there is no business or game of golf. And so, you know, it starts with that 4:30 in the morning wake up call, where our 20,000 members wake up day in and day out to produce great playing surfaces. And I think they're doing a tremendous job, and they need that pat on the back. They're not asking for it, but they so deserve it. And I'm so appreciative of their efforts as a golfer. And certainly, as the CEO of GCSAA, I couldn't be prouder of their efforts, whether it's doing things with First Green, which helps youngsters learn about STEM education, or it's being a grassroots ambassador, talking to their constituents about what the game means and the property means. So it's just fun to watch all of their work and certainly to recognize them for their efforts.
Brett, for most people in this game, summiting Mount Everest is going to the Masters, but I've heard a rumor that you're actually flipping that metaphor on its head this year.
Well, I think the rumor is true. I don't know that my wife's agreeing with it, but yeah, we're going to try to summit Mount Everest, just this little peak in the Himalayas that I think is 29,000 feet tall. So unfortunately, it's going to be going on during the Masters, but I think we'll be able to get a signal at base camp, at least to see how the Masters tournament is doing, and away we go, onward.
Well, Red, be careful. If you need to practice, you got Superstition Mountain and Camelback in the neighborhood in Arizona. Thanks for the time.
Great. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Not much grass on Mount Everest to be seen. In theory, winning early should take the pressure off for the remainder of the season, but we're going to find out if that actually applies in the intense race on the Corn Ferry Tour. After the break, we're going to talk to Jeremy Paul, who just won the season opener in the Bahamas. We'll be right back. Back on Golf Today, and we turn our attention to the Corn Ferry Tour. The season kicked off earlier this month with the Bahamas Great Exuma Classic at Sandals Emerald Bay. 29-year-old Jeremy Paul got his first victory on the Corn Ferry Tour with back-to-back 67s over the last two rounds. He entered the season with fully exempt status from finishing 56th on last year's Corn Ferry Tour points list. And off to a hot start this year, he played collegiately at the University of Colorado. He's 1 minute older than his twin brother, Yannick, and he's been around. He's played on the PGA Tour Latino America, the DP World Tour, PGA Tour Canada, and is now in pretty good shape to play next year on the PGA Tour.
Take a look at the Corn Ferry Tour points list. Here's Jeremy Paul. There's an Eldrick Woods and an Aldrick Potgieter. So 500 points for the two winners so far on the Corn Ferry Tour this season. It's great to be joined by Jeremy Paul on this Tuesday. Congratulations. You know, Jeremy, one thing you said was that, you know, sleeping on a lead can be a little bit tricky. You're alone in your room. Where does your mind go when you're holding on to a 54-hole lead?
Hey guys, thank you for having me. Yeah, that's the worst place actually. When you know the mind goes a lot of places, and a lot of places that you don't want it to go. So in the morning, especially when you have kind of like a later tea time, I was, you know, kind of working around doing stuff just to stay busy, because you really don't want your mind to wander and think about the what ifs. And obviously you're a little nervous. I think it's more about accepting that you're going to be nervous, and it kind of starts the night before. And yeah, I did a lot of work preparing for, you know, situations like this, because obviously that's what you practice for. You hope that to be in a position like this at some point. And yeah, it helped a lot.
But you seem to execute on the practice, because you played a pretty darn solid final round with 5 birdies, no bogeys. You win by a shot. Did that pressure or nerves change the closer you got to the finish line?
Yeah, I was actually in the whole time. I felt like I was in really good control, but I was just waiting for the moment, you know, when I was going to be really nervous. But I think the golf course itself helped me a lot, because the finishing stretch on that golf course is very challenging. So I knew if I wouldn't, you know, unless I'm on the 18th green, it's not really over, and it's still everybody's tournament. So it really helped me to stay in the present and not really get ahead of myself and ever think about winning. Until really I walked up to the 18th green and asked my caddy, Josh, hey, because I didn't ever look at the leaderboard. I asked him, how's it looking? Do we have a lead? And he told me we have a two-shot lead. So I was like, okay, wow, this might actually happen, yeah.
Jeremy, your twin brother, Yannick, on DP World Tour. You guys talk almost every day. You play practice rounds together. I'm the father of triplet boys, 12-year-olds. They play tennis. I'm trying to keep them from putting like a babolat, you know, the tattoo on their forehead with a racket. How did you guys kind of stay competitive without beating each other up? When does that maturity kick in?
Yeah, it was really difficult growing up. If you would ask my parents, they would probably give you a little different story. But yeah, until we were like about 12 or 13, we would basically fight every day. And, you know, it wasn't always pretty. But at the end of the day, we always, you know, loved each other. And by the time I think like about, yeah, 12, 13, so kind of the age that you kids are in, we kind of turned the corner a little bit, and, you know, we were more, you know, we stopped kind of fighting and really trying to help each other. And You know, since it's kind of, golf is like an individual game, so we never really, we compete with each other in practice and stuff, and that really helps. I think that really gives us a little bit of an edge compared to other players when you have someone to practice with every day. And I mean, I know his game really well. He knows my game a lot. And so we can really help each other. And it was really helpful after Christmas. We were in Germany and then we went back to Arizona and we practiced together for about 10, 11 days and played a ton of golf together. And it really, you know, helped us both a lot to get ready for the season. And yeah, I think it's a big benefit for both of us to have someone, we're both in the same boat together, kind of going step by step in our career. So I think it's a huge benefit. And yeah, I'm not sure I couldn't do it without him really, because we bounce so many ideas off each other and talk every day that it's encouraging.
Yannick played really well last year on the DP World Tour, came very close to making the Ryder Cup team. But for you, it was a bit of a mixed bag. You made 26 starts around the world, top 10, 10 missed cuts. What changed for you in the stuff that you worked through last year and over the off season to turn around and win in your first start out this year?
Yeah, I mean, the results might not show, but I really felt like last year I got better. I had a lot of tournaments where I had three good rounds and then like one not so good round. And on the Korn Ferry Tour, you know, that just if you play one round, around even par, it really throws you back a lot. So I had a bunch of top 25s, but I never really had that, you know, one tournament where I had four rounds that I put together that turned out really well. And then over the off season, I think I did a good analysis of that and I really stayed positive and I really felt like I was in a good spot. I worked with my mental coach a lot and, you know, I think that was kind of an approach that we had. We looked more at the positives and thought that there was a lot of good stuff. And I was really fine tuning my short game, especially my putting. I did a few changes on mainly the setup rather than the stroke per se. And yeah, it really helped me to see the line a lot better. And yeah, I was able to make a lot of key putts when it mattered on the weekend.
Jeremy, growing up with ice and cold weather, wind, tough conditions, have those things kind of steeled you and toughened you and your brother as you both endeavor to meet up on the PGA Tour one day?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helps more mentally. So, because we went through phases where, you know, we couldn't really get proper practice in outside. So it's more about, you know, working on other things, working on mental toughness, making the best of what you're given at a situation. And I think that helps you a lot because you're going to be throughout a golf tournament, you're going to be a lot in spots where, you know, you're challenged in certain areas. And it's really just trying to look at the positives, finding things to, you know, still get better. And I think it really helps you at the end of the day.
We've just seen that you are tied for first in the Korn Ferry Tour points list. Winning doesn't necessarily guarantee you the card. Five winners last year didn't actually end up with their tour card at the end of the year. So does this reset your goals for the year?
Not really. I mean, the goal at the beginning obviously was to get my PGA Tour card. I know that a win, especially early in the season, sets you up really well and gives you a lot of confidence going forward. But I mean, now when I'm looking at the fields of all the PGA Tour events, I see that it's really key to be somewhat high up on the points list. And obviously the closer that you are to the number one spot, the more chance you get on the PGA Tour. So I think the goal for me switched in that sense that I'm not just trying to get my PGA Tour card. I'm trying to, you know, get as high as possible on the points list so that I get the most opportunities on the PGA Tour next year.
Jeremy, how about a little travel insight as you go from the Bahamas to Panama where you are now? What was the journey like and what's Panama like?
Yeah, I went home actually for a couple of days because since the tournament in Abacos ended on a Wednesday, I went home to Scottsdale for a couple of days, spent a couple of days with my wife and our dog and just reset. And it was nice, you know, nice little couple of days of breaks, separates those, four tournaments. And then yesterday I flew to Panama. It's not bad, actually. I went through Houston, so it was pretty quick travel. And Panama, I like, this is a great challenging golf course. Played here the last 2 years and I like it. Usually firms up throughout the weekend and it's usually a really good test. So I'm excited for the week.
Jeremy, congratulations. Have a great week. When I get home, I'm telling my boys the story of Jeremy and Yannick and the maturity coming at this time of life, age 12. Thanks for the time, pal.